Welcome, folks. You are listening to the A Minute to Midnight show. My name is Tony, and what you're about to hear is a very interesting discussion I had with Doug Woodward and Gary Huffman on the Middle East, the US, the Gog Magog situation, and I hope you enjoy it because it was a fascinating discussion to have and be a part of. We welcome Doug Woodward and Gary Huffman back to the A Minute to Midnight show. How are you two?
I'm wonderful. Just doing great. How about you, Gary?
I am swell here in Montana.
Ah, swell. I haven't heard that word for a while.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah. Gary's a throwback.
Yeah.
I'm retro.
Yeah. It certainly reminds me of the past, some of my past days as well. So, so I think we're going to begin by talking a lot about what's actually going on in the Middle East and the whole situation, which seems to be the number one talking point in the world at the moment.
Yes.
Yes, I reckon it's going to be a very interesting discussion. So much going on over there, and it's pretty scary in some ways and unsettling.
Mm, I agree. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, there's certainly, for decades now, every time something happens in the Middle East, everyone gets kind of on the edge of their seats and saying, is this it? Is this when we're going to see the Battle of Gog and Magog? Is this going to happen now? So I think that's where so many people are right now, believing that we are poised on the precipice that is just about ready to happen. And it's a very timely subject, no doubt.
I agree. It is. And things have never looked closer than what they are now to, well, basically a World War III scenario, really.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. Not since 1963, I think, or 1962, Gary. I think the Cuban Missile Crisis, that was as close as we have come. We are not quite at that same alert level, but those of us that have studied it, in fact, one of the books I've written is called Is Russia Destined to Nuke the U.S.? And so I've come up with some very specific scenarios as to why I believe that actually the U.S. is going to be attacked with nuclear weapons just prior to the Gog and Magog war. So that might be something that would be of interest to your listeners, Tony.
Yes, well, we can definitely discuss that. See, it's interesting. I see today even, reports, Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, saying on Sunday that Washington will impose new economic sanctions on Russia for Russia's support of Bashar al-Assad. And, she's saying that Secretary Mnuchin or whatever you pronounce his name will be announcing.
It's pretty close.
Yeah, that's well, good. They'll be close. Announcing them as maybe tomorrow or even today.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that guy is a Council on Foreign Relations man. And
Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And it was really interesting, that I think they're pushing Russia closer and closer to some war, really. And even, former Congressman Ron Paul questioned the accusations against Assad, saying, I cannot see any reason why Assad would do this. There's no reasons for the Russians to have done it. And Trump might be playing us with a fiddle, and that the benefactors of the Syrian gas attacks are neocons and the military-industrial complex. So, the whole premise for the strikes the other day was that Bashar al-Assad had used chemical weapons against his own people. And yet, where's the proof?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, that's very much the case. I know we have, a newsman here on Fox, Tucker Carlson, has been ranting about this for the last couple of evenings on his show on Fox News. I don't know if your listeners will be very familiar with him or not, but he's been on TV for 20 years or more, but he's very conservative, but he happens to be a Trump supporter. But on this topic, he is not a Trump supporter. He feels like that there's been little to no evidence. A year ago, almost exactly at the same time, the same scenario occurred where Trump says he wants to pull out of Syria, and then immediately there is a chemical attack, and immediately he fires missiles. And then later, it's basically admitted that not only was there no real evidence, the evidence would lead one to believe it was the Syrian rebels that were doing it just to try to trick the United States into attacking Russia to bring about world sentiment against Bashar al-Assad, and to try to get him out of there. So it's very confusing, very confusing. There's so many players in the issue of Syria, Iran, Turkey, the Kurds, Russia, obviously Assad's government. And you have, so you really have five players in that territory. All of them have different agendas. And, Russia has an agenda, even though it's aligned with Iran and with Hezbollah, and it has a loose alliance with Turkey, and Turkey now and Iran have a loose alliance with one another. You still have the Kurds, and the Kurds have now decided to align with Syria. And so it is really hard to figure out who's threatening who.
Well, you mentioned the rebels, or the so-called rebels, Well, my understanding is that 80 or 90% of those rebels, those fighting against the Assad regime, are actually foreigners, that many of them don't even speak Arabic. And they come from all sorts of other countries, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Libya, even Chechnians and all sorts of other people. And that, by and large, a lot of the Syrian people actually like Bashar al-Assad, and he's not the monster that he's being painted to be. Which, of course, it's hard to really know the truth. But, yeah, Gary, have you got any thoughts on it all?
Oh, well, actually, I was just looking at this one article. I don't think I posted it for you, and I don't know if you've seen it or not, but from the Government Rag. Trump succeeds like no one before the gaslighting of America. Anyway, so He says, he mentions this, which I'm sure both of you are familiar with. This is what he says. Furthermore, making this story hard to swallow is the fact that Assad knows the USA would use his gassing as an immediate reason to continue with the plans outlined by Wesley Clark in 2007, that where he says a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria. So, it seems like this has been planned, and they're just continuing with that plan.
Yeah, it was sort of set aside and delayed, but the neocons and many want to associate the Zionists with the neocons, that they have been, basically planning to do this to make Israel safe and to create what's known as the Greater Israel. And, as a separate subject, that's probably another show for another time, Tony. But this whole issue of the more, I'd say, the greater skepticism of the younger, sort of the millennials regarding Israel as the people of God, Israel, the prophecy of Israel returning to its land as a cornerstone for Bible prophecy. So many of the younger set are challenging that and wondering if Israel really should be seen more as an occupier, and whether or not Zionism really is just another name for neoconservatism, or vice versa. And so that itself is become and is continuing to grow into kind of a festering sore in this whole issue. It's another reason why a lot of people have come to question dispensationalism, because it gets into this issue of Christian Zionism and a lot of hate happening right now on that whole subject. And we're seeing that in the States a whole lot.
Actually, it's interesting. I dealt with that very subject in some YouTube comments on another video I'd done just yesterday, and and pointed out you've got to look it back to Jeremiah chapter 31 and Ezekiel 38 and 39 for those people that don't believe that Israel. You have to really seriously twist scripture to have replacement theology in that. But having said that, I think, you know, my pet thing is everyone is looking for a bad guy and a good guy all the time. It's like you mm-hmm. have this one is the bad guy, that one's the good guy, and, you know, it's sort of like there isn't any in between for a lot of people. But I think it's there right. is no bad guy and good guy. It's a mixture of everyone is a mixture of, well, I mean, there's a lot of bad guys, but no one is purely a good guy. And Israel right. is no yeah. exception. I fully believe in Israel's right to exist. But I'm mm-hmm. also well and truly aware that there's a lot that's not right that's occurring there either. And, you know, and the biggest certainly thing is there are two camps largely, the people that believe Israel can do no right and shouldn't exist at all. And then there's the extreme Christian Zionists, on the other hand, that believe Israel mm-hmm. can do no wrong. And so everyone else is the bad guy and Israel's a good guy. And I just don't think it's that simple.
Yeah, it's really not. It's really not. And there's, you know, on the one hand, as you were saying, you've got the replacement theology sort of group, which has really been kind of that's really been Reformation theology. I mean, really, Martin Luther, John Calvin, Zwingli and others, they certainly believed in Reformation, or rather in the replacement theology, as did obviously the Catholic Church. So that part, the Reformers and the Catholics continued to agree on. The English were different, which is, it's really kind of striking, because whereas there's a lot of criticism that this whole dispensational thing, the love of Israel, Israel Zionism, really began with John Darby. In fact, I'm looking at a book right now by, is it William Watson? Let me see, double check his last name here. I think that's what it is. And it's called, William Watson, Dispensationalism Before Darby. And it's a great book. He's a professor at Colorado at Denver Seminary. And I've had a chance to meet William. Gary and I did last summer. And but, you know, he points out that 200 years before Darby, you had, English clergymen strongly in of the belief that Israel would return physically to its land, and that it would become a that it would flower again, that it would become a nation again, and that it would happen in the last days. I mean, they read the same Bible that we do, even though they were reading it 300-400 years ago, and mm-hmm. And that this was going to happen, and that the concept of what they believed it was should be called was instead of dispensationalism, they called it restorationism. And but as you read it, you just kind of go, wow, these guys were, I mean, they and John Darby could have been right on the same page, because that's what they were saying. And so the whole issue of, you know, dispensationalism being kind of a Johnny come lately belief of from the 1830s, you know, with Margaret MacDonald and her vision and all that. Yeah, it's just historically just totally wrong, you know. So good scholarship says, no, that's not at all true. Just look up restorationism on Wikipedia, and you can get a pretty good glimpse of it from that standpoint. So it's an area I've studied actually a lot, and it's an area that I tend to believe is vital to properly understand the whole context of modern-day biblical prophecy.
Well, the thing is, there's never in the history of the world been such a thing that's happened as 2,000 years of scattering of a people to the ends of the earth and then being brought back to the land and becoming a people again. And as it says in Jeremiah 31, and I know a lot of people say, no, Israel is just the Rothschilds. It's not God's hand at all, you know, and that's all.
Right,
the whole Khazarian theory, which I think is nonsense and all that. But having mm-hmm. said that, there is some truth, you know, the Rothschilds did have a big role in it. I'm not at all a supporter of the Rothschilds. I try and expose them as much as I possibly can and mm-hmm. all of that. But, you know, God can still use even the evil to bring about his desired purpose. And in the end, it's not about Israel being anybody or Jews being anyone special or supremacists or whatever. It's about God showing his faithfulness in the end in spite of them almost rather than because of them.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And Gary and I, we, you know, I'd say violently agree with you.
And I mean, I'll be completely honest here, and I haven't really said it too many times on the show. I've very much Jewish heritage myself, so people can say, aha, there's a Zionist. Aha. Well, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, I recognize my Jewishness. I've never been brought up in the Jewish faith, but that's very much a part of me. But at the same time, I'm certainly not one of these people that just sits there and blindly accepts everything that is done by the state of Israel, you know. But I do believe they have the right to exist. Going off sorry, Gary?
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, if we haven't said it already, God has a plan for Israel. That's the bottom line. And like you say, it may be in spite of them, but he has a plan for Israel, and he's going to show his glory through the church and through Israel in the last days. So looking forward to that.
Exactly.
Yep. Okay, now I just want to backtrack a little bit off that, back to the U.S. situation in all of this. And it was really, really interesting. This is something that Joni Stahl wrote the other day after watching a video. It says this: if this doesn't pull the mask off the globalists, I don't know what will. Genie Oil given permission to drill for oil in Bashan, that's Golan Heights. Just watch to see the diversity of the board of advisors. Dick Cheney, former vice president under Bush. Mary Laundrex, former Democrat senator in Louisiana. Bill Richardson, former governor New Mexico. Yep. Jacob Rothschild, and it was granted rights under the Netanyahu administration and so on. And she says, remember the Golan Heights sits on top of a volcano and an earthquake fault that goes from Kenya to Syria next to Israel. That region could be about to explode in ways not considered. But there you have it, you know, the gas and oil pipeline and the oil in the Golan Heights. The reason that Syria is such a powder keg and a center of everyone is because there's profit to be made there. Russia wouldn't be bothering with Syria if there wasn't control of the Middle East, if there wasn't gas, if there wasn't money. And the same with the US. So the whole chemical weapons thing is a facade and an excuse.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, it's certainly, you've got you know, the pipelines that the Americans want to see come across Syria. They, you know, they want those pipelines to come across from Oman and Bahrain, and really Saudi Arabia, Eastern Saudi Arabia, and so you've got that as a strong motivation for what's happening. You've got the Russians that, of course, would prefer that those pipelines not happen. So they'd like to continue to control Syria so that they can keep those pipelines from happening, so that they can continue to push oil and gas, natural gas, through their pipelines into Europe, which really, as I recall, their pipelines run through the Balkans and through Turkey. And so that's the way they want to go, because it will increase the amount of revenue that they generate. So the pipelines in Syria would have a big negative impact upon the Russian economy. And of course, as we like to say, I wrote a blog about 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, and I said it's the oil stupid or it's the economy stupid. You know, it's not about Russian bots. It's about Russia. The economic issues associated with Russia, and what they're dealing with, the falling ruble, the falling price of the ruble, the falling price of oil, and so on. And so that really is, that's a key factor in looking at what's happening in the Middle East right now.
Right. Yeah, there's really, I mean, a lot of people would say there's absolutely no civil war in Syria, but it's just a proxy war, and which seems to be getting closer to a real war.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, it is. It is. Yeah. Go ahead, Tony.
Well, I don't know. Gary, you saw it this morning, I know, that Nathan Liao made it an article, and in it he shared a video of John Bolton. And I'm going to quote what Bolton actually said in this video. The behavior and objectives of the regime are not going to change. He's speaking about Iran here. and therefore the only situation is to change the regime itself. Then the crowd claps and cheers wherever he was this speech. And that's why before 2019 we will celebrate in Tehran. Thank you very much. So, I mean, if that doesn't tell you.
Yep.
You know, this is the guy that Trump has just put in. You know, just before these strikes happened. And also, it's interesting that when Mattis met Bolton, apparently he told him, "I've heard you're actually the devil incarnate, and I wanted to meet you."
Yeah.
Well, isn't it true? I mean, Bolton, of course, has been, you know, a neocon's neocon. There were some feelings that perhaps he had an epiphany and that he had a new point of view. But, I've not seen that. To me, it still appears that he's very aggressive and that he wants the United States to continue to flex its military muscle and to continue to gain back control of the oil fields in the Middle East, which have really been the cause of all the wars of the last 120 years from World War One forward, because it really was right before World War One that everyone figured out, at least the British figured out, that oil had something like 7 times more effectiveness than coal did, and that for them to continue to sail the deep blue seas and be the dominant naval power, they needed to both change all of their ships over to oil instead of coal, and that they needed to secure supplies. And so really World War One was in terms of the real reasons for fighting World War One, it was all about the oil. And I can go into more detail in terms of, you know, the train tracks and where those train tracks were going to go and so forth, really Baghdad to Berlin, and the British didn't want that to happen. And so, it was like just another case of a false flag. So you can look at virtually every war in the Western Hemisphere, and it always comes back to oil, comes back to the economy. And it's no different now. It's still the same factor influencing things. So it's pretty remarkable.
Well, if there was no oil, no gas pipeline, and no dollars to be made, the West wouldn't really care what Assad does, would they? I mean, let's face it, they don't care about the genocides in other countries.
Well, that's exactly right. Yeah, they don't.
And I don't mean to downplay people if there were people gassed, but it was 40 people or 70 people. There's much worse genocide going on that we don't seem to care about.
No, that's right. Yeah, you can talk about Sudan, or you can talk about a number of countries in Asia, in Africa, that we're not taking those kinds of steps. It's, you know, this issue of the chemical warfare, chemical usage being the point that makes a difference, that causes the U.S. to take action. Let's face it, we all agree that it didn't really make a lot of sense for Assad to use chemical weapons on his people at this point in time. And yet the other side of things is that we know for a fact that Assad was bombing his own people with barrel bombs, because he was the one that had helicopters that could drop barrel bombs on civilians, and he was doing it all the time. So we know that he stoops to do that. Now, whether or not he used chemical warfare, you know, he certainly is willing to kill his own people. He is a barbarian, and so we know that. So, but the real question, you know, and I wrote a little blog today, I think it was, or yesterday, about Trump. Was this really just a PR stunt? You know, who really stands to benefit? Was Trump doing this just to change the narrative? Once again, you know, is it just a matter of saying, well, the media is giving me a hard time over here about loving Russia, 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 and I need to demonstrate that, you know, I'm willing to drop bombs on Russians in the Middle East, and by doing that will improve my public relations situation in the States. And so it is true that by warning the Russians that they cleared things out, they cleared out probably a lot of the equipment and the chemicals themselves, if they were in fact producing chemical weapons at these locations. And so it was, yeah, they destroyed the buildings, but the buildings may have had nothing in them by the time that the bombs actually landed. So yes. It looks like, and my take on it is that it was just for show. It was not really to have a big impact. And the fact that Russia's done virtually nothing yet in retaliation, it's probably because they sense that it was not necessarily to really cripple Russia's influence and position in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, if Bolton, you know, has his way, and
he might.
And, yeah, I mean, here we go. He's the National Security Advisor of the United States, and he's talking about overthrowing the regime in Iran.
Right.
And yet they are constantly going on at Russia about saying that Russia's meddling in other people's politics and countries.
Right.
And yet, you know, the U.S. is doing it and has done for a long, long time. See, one thing I start to wonder, you know, is with them calling Russia meddling and all that, it's like the pot calling the kettle black. And really, is this all designed to make America look bad in the eyes of the rest of the world ultimately? You know, and is the answer to this kind of war hawkishness that ends up having to be stopped either by, you know, America being nuked or whatever, but the ultimate answer being global government and the destruction of the American empire, which, of course, Donald Trump, you know, just in his speech the other day, again, calling America the greatest and most prosperous nation in the history of the world, which sounds like the hammer of the whole earth to me from Jeremiah 50.
Yeah, and I kind of feel like Make America Great Again is all about that. You know, it's not the thing that all the patriots, which I considered myself, you know, were looking for. It's not that. It is staying the hammer of the whole earth, you know.
Yeah.
Well, are you guys familiar with the PNAC document? Have you ever heard of that?
Go ahead. Describe it a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I am definitely not an expert on this, but I know Nathan and his wife talk about it in that audio, Tony, that I posted on your Facebook there. And I've heard of it before. I've heard the Hagmans talk about it. It's PNAC stands for Project for a New American Century.
Okay.
I believe it was written right around 9/11. I don't know if it was after or right before.
It's really the fundamental document upon which the neoconservative movement was based, if I'm not mistaken. Yep. Is that right? Yes. I just hadn't heard it called that, but that's exactly right. Yeah.
Well, PNAC, I guess, is the it was a report of the Project for the New American Century, but actually the name of the document was Rebuilding America's Defenses. But John Bolton was part of that. He had a hand in that, and a lot of people thought that they were done with this after they went into Iraq and were done with Iraq, but now we're realizing with John Bolton back in that this PNAC document, they're still trying to enforce this and bring about. It's basically a strategy, you know, to make America great again.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, you can try to, you know, it may seem like splitting hairs, but you can, you know, look at the issue of why did the globalists want America to be all powerful? Why did the globalists want America? Why did they want a unipolar world? And it really was so that America could serve as the muscle or the enforcer for a single global government. But if you're saying make America great again, make America's military the most powerful military in the world so that we can defend ourselves or use our military military at our, you know, at our beck and call, at our will. You know, when you look at it from that standpoint, there is no difference. You know, and of course, Hitler was a nationalist. He was a national socialist, but he was a nationalist. And so from that standpoint, nationalism and globalism can be absolutely, you know, really do the same things. It's more like the isolationism, which is really what Rand Paul, you know, promotes, as did Patrick Buchanan and others. And that really has been historically America's preferred position, going all the way back to George Washington, who said basically don't have entangling alliances with the Europeans. And so America has historically been isolationist. But really, since the League of Nations, since World War One, the globalists really have been driven for the most part out of the United States. Woodrow Wilson, the League of Nations, the Rockefellers, and the United Nations, and so forth. So all the globalism really has been, it's been predominantly United States pushing it. And of course, that kind of gets us back into this issue of the daughter of Babylon. And, you know, is the United States really behind, predominantly the key power behind the movement towards globalism? I just personally think that Trump is so, I mean, I'm kind of very excited about Trump disrupting things, but I think Trump is so poorly educated on history and on geopolitics and on the neoconservative point of view that, you know, it never fazed him and never occurred to him what John Bolton's involvement in being the national security advisor really meant, that it would tend to reposition or re-strengthen the position of globalists. And sometimes he just makes decisions that absolutely fly in the face of what it is that he says he wants to do. And certainly Bolton was a case in point.
Well, I believed long before the election that Donald Trump was going to be the next president, and that it wouldn't be to come against the move towards a new world order, but that Donald Trump is actually a part of this whole plan to bring in the new world order. And I mean, I kind of ranted a bit about it months and months before the election, I think, and people thought, Trump was an outsider. And well, all of us in the Minute to Midnight team, right from the word go, a year out, were believing that Trump was going to be the next president. And I was not at all surprised when he was. And so, yeah, I don't think he's as stupid as people think. I mean, yeah, he's a hothead, and I don't actually think he's blindly, doing this. I think this is a calculated plan.
Well, what I'm hearing you say is that it is a calculated plan that he may be a part of, but it really is it's really a head fake. It's a misleading plan, because at the end of the day, he's really, when I hear you saying, Tony, it's not like that he really wants to alter the course. He's just part of the controlled opposition, that he's a useful idiot, if you will, that it's still on path. America's still on path to lead towards, you know, globalism, the new world order, and all of that. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the $64,000 question really is, Donald Trump a useful idiot, or is he an integral part of the plan and knows it and always has known it? That's the thing that I think, I don't think we can be totally sure at this point, but his actions are leading more and more to show that he is not he's not standing on what he claimed he was there for before the election anyway.
Right. He seems to be a willing accomplice to me.
Yeah.
See, I don't think it's a question of him being, an idiot or being stupid. I actually think he's very, very smart. I just think he's very poorly educated on geopolitics and history. And so he, even relatively recent, relatively contemporary history, in terms of what's been driving geopolitics in the last, let's say, two decades. I just think he doesn't really get it, and that it just hasn't been an area that he's cared about. I believe that Trump was driven. This is where I tend to agree with Jerome Corsi, who, argues that the military was going to perform a coup and take out Obama. They came back and decided not to. They decided that they could accomplish their objectives by getting Trump elected, and that the military promised Trump security, that they would protect him, and that no one would get to him, that they would get him into office, and the military would back him. And I don't believe that the military is necessarily nationalist. I tend to think that it's heavily, can be very much new world order as well. I had, I don't know if I mentioned this, Tony, or not. I had a chance to have lunch with General Boykin about 5 weeks ago, I guess. And we talked quite a bit about the different generals. And one of the generals we talked about was Jim Mattis, who's the, of course, Secretary of Defense now. And Boykin, you know, basically indicated to me that he felt that Mattis was a relatively liberal guy, kind of more of a New World Order kind of guy, the Chief of Staff, General John's last name? Kelly, John Kelly, who's the Chief of Staff, that he's more conservative, more, you know, in the Christian fold. But, you know, regardless, you've got people that were, I think you've got military people that were very dead against Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and they really disagreed with where they were going because they felt that they were taking America down a Marxist socialist approach, that they were trying to ruin the strength of America. But that's why it's such a difficult topic. It's because I think that the military is still predominantly globalist, and they want America to be great, but they want America to be great so it can continue to be the hammer of the whole earth. And that Barack Obama clearly was ridding himself of a lot of generals, dozens of people that were opposing him. And so what you're ending up with now is you're ending up with generals that are predominantly globalist. They still believe in the neocon point of view, but they don't necessarily want to see America destroyed in the process the way that Obama and I believe Clinton wanted to. So that's my take.
Interestingly, at the inauguration of Trump, he had the military standing right behind him too.
Indeed.
Yes.
No, I think there's a message there. Absolutely.
There was a big message here, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this can I just read this short little piece in out of this same article that I mentioned before?
For sure.
He says, how convenient, Trump completes the task started by Obama on behalf of the neocons in Israel, attacking Assad and prosecuting war in Syria. Then he says, the next stop in the destruction and resurrection of the Middle East, Greater Israel, will be Iran. Be waiting for Trump's excuse for why we must attack Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes right along with John Bolton's proclamation there.
So right. who was yes. that article written by again?
Let me see if I can figure that out. The guy's name is Jack Mullen, and it was in the governmentrag.wordpress.com.
I don't know if there used to be a General Mullen. I don't know if that was. It would say General Jack Mullen, though, if it was.
It's just Jack Mullen, yeah.
Yeah, so isn't General Mullen, yeah.
This is a pretty darn good article.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that's what we're looking at. And I think that Russia understands that. Putin's no dummy. And Putin is trying to come up with a way to bring together Turkey and Iran, which are not natural allies. They are natural enemies because obviously Turkey is predominantly a Sunni country, and obviously Iran is predominantly a Shia country. But Russia is trying to bring together them in an alliance to thwart the plans of Israel and the United States to destroy Syria so that the pipelines can come through. And I think that Russia has a relatively, kind of a very narrow focus in terms of, you know, they're kind of myopic. They have a very narrow focus in what they want. It's not so much that they want Israel to be destroyed as they want the opportunity for their pipelines to continue to be the only pipelines sourcing oil and gas for the Europeans.
Right.
Whereas the Turkey and Iran, they have very clear goals. They want Israel destroyed.
Right. And I don't think Russia really wants war. I think, like you say, they just want what they want, and they right. like to do it without war.
The hook in the jaw, though, it may be set.
Yeah.
This may be part of the hook, you know.
We're poking the bear, and yeah, you're right. The hook is coming.
So, yeah. Doug, you actually have written a book called The Next Great War in the Middle East.
I have. Yeah, it's been out for a couple of years, and it still holds true. Don't have to fix anything in it. It's still, it's still very current in terms of what's going on.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah.
Maybe you could give a very brief sort of outline of that book, maybe.
Sure. Well, some of the highlights. The first 80 or 90 pages or so really is recapping what's gone on in the Middle East since the Arab Spring and with the withdrawal of the American troops in Iraq and the creation of ISIS and the war against ISIS. So the first 80 or 90 pages really provide kind of an overview of that as a setup for what the second part of the book really is focused on, which is the war of Gog and Magog, why what's happened in Iraq and Syria is a prelude to the next great war. I argue against Psalm 83. I believe Psalm 83, and for that matter, the Islamic Antichrist, both of those theories rely upon a similar hermeneutic, which is that, well, I won't go there. It's kind of confusing. It's the whole geographical issue and which nation is really talked about in the Bible prophecy. But essentially, both of those require a sort of a 25 to 30 year extension before those prophecies can really be fulfilled. Now, Bill Salas would say, because he and I have talked about this, he would say that Israel, Psalm 83 war could happen at any time. And if he's right, then it could. Joel Richardson and the Islamic Antichrist theory, he doesn't believe in the Psalm 83 war. So he and I agree on that. He believes, though, that Armageddon and Gog and Magog are one and the same war. He believes that Gog and Magog, that the Prince of Gog, is the same as the Mahdi. It's the same as the Antichrist. It's all one and the same. But again, they both believe that we're looking at like 25 to 30 years from now before the final event can occur. And the reason is that there's scenarios that they argue for. They're not in play yet. They take a while for them to fully blossom and for them to make perfect sense. Turkey's not ready to be the dominant Middle Eastern power. It shows signs of that. Left to its own devices over the next 20 to 30 years, it could certainly become that, but it's not that right now. And, there's other things, too, that cause problems with Joel's point of view. One time he really believed that, Egypt, for instance, was the king of the south, Daniel 11. I have come to be almost a preterist on Daniel 11. I'm a futurist overall, but Daniel 11 I tend to become a preterist on. But anyway, the issue of how long it takes before Gog and Magog could occur, both of those two very, very popular points of view suggest that it's not going to happen for a while. My point of view is that it can all happen. It can all kick off right away. That Gog and Magog, the opening sort of salvo of Gog and Magog is a surprise attack on the United States by nations from the north, as Jeremiah describes them, which is, I believe, China, Russia, and probably North Korea, that they will forge an alliance or a pact, that missiles will come across the pole, hence the attacks will be from the north as it pertains to the United States, that the United States will be, for all intents and purposes, destroyed, and that concurrent with that, the United States, predominantly, predictably, New York would be one of the main targets. I also speculate, based upon Ezekiel 38:13, that which talks about Sheba and Dedan, the merchants of Tarshish and the young lions, that the city of London, as well as New York, could certainly be targets of the Russians, because it would just, you know, in terms of destroying the petrodollar, destroying the dollar itself as the reserve currency, you would need to take essentially both of those cities out. And the other argument is that Sheba and Dedan is interestingly linked there with the United States and with London, because of the petrodollar. And that it's very conceivable that if Russia were to align with Turkey and Iran, that Iran and Turkey would both want the Saudi Arabians to no longer control Mecca and Medina, that they would, you know, want to eradicate the Saudis and take control of their most holy holy sites. And so, you know, whereas the traditional point of view in Ezekiel 38:13 is that you know, that the evil thought has come into the mind of Gog and so forth, and that Sheba and Dedan, the merchants of Tarshish, the young lions, are all kind of in a holding pattern, all kind of in like, gee whiz, you know, Gog, why did you come against Israel? And, you know, we're not going to be able to do anything to help Israel out, so we're just going to kind of sit here on our hands. Well, my argument, and there's quite a few arguments in several chapters in the book, is that Russia, along with Iran, and of course other nations that are mentioned in Ezekiel 38 and 39, it's moving against the United States, which I believe a strong argument can be made that it is the land of unwalled villages, not Israel. Israel's already been dealt with prior to verse 10 in chapter 38, and the way that verse 10 sets up in Ezekiel is that it's like at the same time, another evil thought will come into your mind. You will want to go up against the land of unwalled villages. Well, and of course, the traditional view is, well, the unwalled villages are Israel. Well, Israel has 417 miles of walls. And so Israel is probably not the unwalled village. And, you know, and if you consider the possibility that the United States and England and Saudi Arabia are the predominating allies right now of Israel, you would want to take them all out and disable their ability to protect Israel before you moved against Israel. So I don't think that the United States, England, and Saudi Arabia are going to be sitting on their hands. I think that the reason they're expressing surprise when Gog moves against the land of unwalled villages is not because he's moving against Israel, but because they're surprised he's moving against them. Mm-hmm. So that's where I take a very different view, and I believe that it's a good point of view that needs to be considered in terms of, you know, of not buying necessarily the traditional scenario that's been offered ever since the time of Hal Lindsey to explain Ezekiel 38:13. And the fellow that wrote the foreword to my book, John Price, also wrote The End of America. John passed away about a year or so ago, but I was of good fortune to have John write the foreword to my book, The Next Great War in the Middle East. And John, you know, basically said he thought I was right on. He said that was quite a stroke of insight. And I go, well, you know, the Holy Spirit gets the credit. I just was reading and it occurred to me that's what I was seeing. You know, that's kind of where we're coming from. So we think the United States is the daughter of Babylon, that it will be destroyed right before Gog and Magog. And of course, another key part of the book is talking about how many of the other prophecy students and scholars, I count myself a student and a writer, not a scholar, that they, you know, in fact, agree with this, that it happened sometime before the 70th week. I'm looking at this one chart that I have in the book, and it includes people like Arnold Fruchtenbaum, Grant Jeffrey, Tim LaHaye, Chuck Missler, Randall Price, Chuck Smith, John Hagee even, and Emil Geverluk, all, and yours truly. All of us believe that it will happen anywhere from 6 months to 3.5 years before the 7-year tribulation begins. And we think that that is what sets up the Antichrist to come on the world scene, to try to bring about peace, to try to restore Western civilization. And of course, the United States is not the only one destroyed. Ezekiel 38 says that Russia will be destroyed. You know, after it destroys the U.S., after God uses it to bring judgment on the United States and England and potentially Saudi Arabia, that God will then bring judgment on Gog and Magog and all of the hordes of nations that are following the leadership of Gog.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting that you bring up London and New York because Saudi Arabia. You know, when you look at Revelation 18:18, mm-hmm. and it says, mm-hmm. and cried when they saw the smoke of a burning, saying, "What city is like unto this great city?" Quite frankly, right. In the world today, I think there's only two cities that could be called that great city. One is New mm-hmm. York, and the other is London. And for the, you know, they are the hubs of the financial hubs of the world. The other place I'm looking at is the potential of the city Neom that Mohammed bin Salman is, you know, looking to be building in Saudi Arabia, which will be like, if that happens according to what his plans is, there will be no city in the world like that. So, you know, I just can't see an Islamic Antichrist. I can't see Mecca being it. I even, you know, Mohammed bin Salman is talking about a moderate Islam and it for being a place that all religions will be welcome. And you know, mm-hmm. I ultimately think the Babylonian religion will be some form of Luciferianism, actually.
Well, that's mm-hmm. my point of view as well, that the final world religion really is occultism, and not that Islam, you know, Islam is in my point of view. There's probably, you might say, good Islam and bad Islam, although ultimately, of course, I believe all of Islam is, you know, is antagonistic towards the Judeo-Christian worldview and specifically mm-hmm. Christ. So it's really, I see it as a Christian, an apostasy of Christianity. That's my sense.
Benjamin Baruch, he also would agree with your timetable.
Yes.
Doug, you know, yep. And one thing that I just heard him talking on a video, and he was talking about, you know, going back to what you were just saying about the Mystery Babylon, the religion. Uh-huh. That we're talking about Luciferianism. He was talking about how the Chaldeans, and he pronounces it Chaldeans, but I prefer Chaldeans. That's just the way I've always said it. That they were basically the mystery religion, and they were assimilated into Babylon, mm-hmm. and you know, kept their mystery religion alive, and it became the religion of Babylon. And that's kind of what's happened to the United States. It's just like the same exact picture, and I could point to some secret societies that have basically, you know, been part of the United States since the beginning and influenced everything. And, you know, it's the same thing happening again. It's like,
That's right. History, was it Mark Twain that said history may not repeat itself, but it does rhyme.
Yeah. Well, this is one of those rhymes. Yeah.
And also don't forget the head of the United Nations is in New York. And I made a video a few weeks back or a couple of months ago now about the Luciferians at the United Nations. And I showed just how rampant Luciferianism is in the United Nations. That it's occult based, and so that's another reason why I think New York could be that city.
Right. Now, in the back of the book, one of the appendixes I mentioned, I think at the beginning, I listed 10 primary reasons, quoting scripture, that and many of these are things that, although they reference Babylon, in some cases, the daughter of Babylon, was not you know, basically a fulfillment of these. It's like looking at these 10 right here. So I'll make sure that, I'll send you several things from this book, Tony, and also a couple of PowerPoints that you can include in the notes if people would like to go in and really dig in, because I go into great depth in this and in a couple of different presentations. I think each one's about 60 slides long. So I really dig into it in detail.
Sounds good. Yeah, our time's kind of getting short now. Have you guys got any other thoughts that you want to add? I mean, we could go on for ages more, and I'll have to get you. I'll have to get you guys to come back again soon, because there are more topics that we got to cover. So, in the interest of not going too long on this show, have you got any sort of thoughts before we give your websites?
Well, I think that we're at a very important point. The next few months bear close scrutiny to see what occurs. I happen to believe that, we can't predict when the Lord will return. I think that there's a lot of people trying to predict that the Lord is coming back in this month, the month of April. We've already had a couple of dates that were, highly predicted. April the 6th, I think, was one. There's reasons to believe that the Lord is, that this period of time kicks off in 2018. Having said that, I'm also really kind of bracing myself for the fact that the Lord may not be coming back for a while. And, the persecution is occurring in great detail and in horror in the Middle East, in the lands that are, predominantly Muslim, but many Christians are being born there through, the great evangelist efforts of so many. I just think that we can't predict it. We can say that this looks like this is the time, but we just need to be prepared. I do think there's a lot of folks that have taken the position that at the moment of sudden destruction, when people are saying peace and safety, then sudden destruction will come upon them. Shalom and Betach, peace and safety, which was actually Benjamin Netanyahu's bumper sticker was Betach in Shalom, peace and safety. That's probably when the Lord will come back. And that seems to be what it's saying. And, J.R. Church used to say that as we are going up in the rapture, the missiles will be coming down and they'll be nipping at our heels. And so those are words of encouragement, and would that it are so, his words to God's ears, right?
Gary, any last thoughts?
Well, and on that, I might differ with Doug just a little bit. I think we may see a missile or two before.
We're
going up. I guess what I would say is, in world events, it seems that all sorts of prophetic things are converging. And I think we're very close to the last week of Daniel. We just need to be, ready for anything, ready to trust the Lord with our lives.
Absolutely. Amen. So can you guys give your websites for our listeners?
Sure. My website is, you can find it a couple ways. Officially, it's faith-happens.com, although people can find it if they just do a search on Doomsday Doug, all one word, doomsdaydoug.com. I noticed recently somebody came up with Doomer Doug. That's also a prophecy person, but I should probably tell them that, I've got the trademark on that, so cease and desist. Anyway, doomsdaydoug.com, and I write a blog or two every week, and then Gary posts them lots of times on the site you manage, Gary, so tell them about your site.
Okay, yeah, the site that I have is the-revealing.com, and that is the site for Doug and my book together, The Revealing. And I'm very slowly putting pieces of the book up there. Eventually, people will be able to read a lot of the book on the website.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Well, yeah, guys, this has been a fantastic discussion. And, you know, there are, like I say, plenty of other subjects that I think we'll be able to cover sometime. So we'll have to get you back on before too long again to cover some of those. So thank you for being on the Minute to Midnight show today. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Tony. It's always great. Yeah, great to have a chance to get together with you.
Folks, A Minute to Midnight is run 100% by donations. We thank those that help contributing to keeping this running. We certainly couldn't do it without you. You can find ways to donate on our website. That's aminutetomidnight.com with midnight spelled M-I-D-N-I-T-E. You can find our shows on there as well as articles. We put our shows on there in video format as well as on audio format. And you can also find them on iTunes and YouTube as well. I write, play, and record all the music in our shows, and you can find some free music on the Minute to Midnight website as well. A Minute to Midnight is run by a team, and we want to say thank you for listening to the show. Don't forget to like the video if you're watching on YouTube, and we'll catch you in another episode of the show in a few days' time. Until then, God bless, and have a great week. We'll be right back.